18 years have passed since Angel broke free of the Tanaka Lagoon and returned to the Marietta Trench. Meanwhile, Jonas Taylor, adventurer, is now a middle-aged father of two. A Hollywood television producer wants Jonas to join his new survival series, Daredevils. For the next 6 weeks, two teams of crazy daredevils will compete on a South Pacific Ocean voyage aboard a replica of an old Spanish sailing ship. Jonas needs the money, and the job seems easy enough doing the color commentary. But behind the scenes, someone else is pulling the string. And before it's over, Jonas, Terry, and Mac will face an unspeakable horror. Steve Alton is our guest, a New York Times award-winning best-selling author. He has written many thrillers. And the passage I just read from his third book of the series, Meg, really makes the hair on the back of your neck stand up. It conjures up the beauty of the South Pacific, along with the terror of a super monster white shark lurking just beneath the waters. Well, Steve, welcome to the show. We have you on the line from Florida. How are things going? How are you?
Very good, Jerry.
By the way, I would like to say, you know, right off the bat that this book, The Resurrection, is an interesting book. We'll talk about some of the other things you've done, too. You're no stranger to the New York Times bestseller list. And let's get right into it. What got you interested in this genre? But I even before I get to that, I notice you have maybe a different type of book coming up pretty soon. At least the picture on the cover was showed the White House on an oil well.
Yeah, that's my eighth novel, which I just completed, called The Shell Game. We're actually shopping at the publishers right now, and I'm hoping to put a deal together and get that out either spring or summer of 2007.
Now, so would this new book be a political thriller or what?
It is. It's a political thriller. It deals with the end of oil, our addiction to oil, the next 9/11 event, which will lead to the invasion of Iran and really the end of civilization.
Well, you better hurry and get it published. we look forward to it. That's probably a good read. I'd like to talk about your current book here for a minute. Why don't you tell our audience the premise?
Well, Resurrection is actually book two in the Domain trilogy, and Domain is about the Mayan calendar's 2,000-year-old prophecy that predicts humanity will end on December 21st in the year 2012. And what the Mayan calendar actually is, it's an instrument of time and space that measures certain astrological things, and it's extremely accurate, and it's almost baffling how accurate this calendar is. In fact, it's a 10,000th of a day more accurate than our current calendar is in measuring how long it takes the Earth to revolve around the Sun. So the last day of this huge calendar ends on the winter solstice of 2012, which many people have interpreted to be the end of humanity. And Domain was the first in the series. Resurrection, which is now out in paperback, is sort of like Matrix meets the Mayan prophecies. But it delves into, Resurrection delves into a different aspect of the story, which is what happens to us after we die, what's the future of the human race, and in the future, the two subjects are really entwined. Science and technology pushes Homo sapiens to evolve into what has been termed transhumans, and it's almost we're becoming more wired into machines. But the afterlife itself it has become a science, and the afterlife is the ultimate frontier. And Resurrection delves into that subject, and while keeping a storyline going from Domain.
Now, you have the same characters?
Many of the same characters, yeah.
Yeah, you got a third book in mind for that series?
Yeah, the third in the trilogy will be Phobos, and so Resurrection is really the middle book in the darker chapter in the trilogy. You can read it separately. I always recommend to read Domain first, and that'll really capture the essence of the story, but you can read Resurrection separately.
Now, when you write this type of book, I immediately think about many of these high budget movies. Anybody in the movie business ever talk to you?
Oh, sure. My first book, Meg, which is about a 70-foot prehistoric great white shark called a megalodon, is has been optioned by New Line Cinema, and we're hoping that'll get green light soon and come out in 2008. We're in some talks with some people about Domain, either as a TV series or possibly a movie, and I've got a couple other projects out there too. So I'm just getting started in the movies, but hopefully it'll work out.
You know, many people listening to us have read your works, but the problem that we have here is the fact that a lot of people don't understand how you are able to spin a narrative by weaving science, myth, and religion together. Or am I misinterpreting how you do it?
No, actually, you hit it right on the head. You know, this is what got me interested in this storyline was that many years ago when I wrote Domain, it started out as a premise, and the premise was, what if the asteroid that struck Earth 65 million years ago and wiped out the dinosaurs, what if that asteroid was something else, not an asteroid, but a different type of body? And you know, the research led me to, first of all, the asteroid hit in the Gulf of Mexico off the Yucatan Peninsula, and the Yucatan Peninsula is where the Mayans dominated for 1,000 years, and once I got into the Mayan culture, and came across the Mayan calendar and this just amazing doomsday prophecy, and I realized there was a real story here. And in every ancient culture, amazingly, there is this figure, an ancient wise man who's described as a tall Caucasian man with long, flowing, silky white hair and beard, deep blue eyes, and sort of an elongated skull. And in the Mayan culture, that wise man was the great teacher Kukulkan. And if you go to Chichen Itza, and I've been there several times, there's a pyramid there, the Kukulkan pyramid, which is a perfect ziggurat of stone. It's a four-sided pyramid with steps. It has 91 steps on each side. The platform at the top makes 365 as in days of the year. So it is a calendar in stone. But amazingly, every fall and spring equinox, when day and night are equal, the shadow of a giant serpent appears on the northern balustrade of the temple, and it appears to slither down the temple steps or slither up, depending upon which equinox it is. And this was made 1,000 years ago, if you can imagine it, this special effect. And it wasn't a tourist attraction. It was an ancient warning of things to come. So this wise man, Kukulkan, who many claim invented this calendar over 1,000 years ago, he really was an enigma because, first of all, he was believed to be Caucasian. Well, there were no Caucasians. There were no white men in Mesoamerica 1,000 years ago. The first white settlers were invaders. They came over 500 years after Kukulkan's passing, and that was Hernan Cortez and this invading Spanish fleet. And amazingly, the Aztec culture also has the same sort of human deity, Quetzalcoatl, who's also described in the same manner. And when the invading Spanish came over and it hit the Yucatan Peninsula, and Montezuma, the Aztec leader, heard that a bearded white man was coming by sea, and he assumed it was Quetzalcoatl come back from the dead, and he let the invading Spanish right into their cities and was eventually conquered. So, you know, myth and science and history, when it meets, it makes for some amazing stories, and Domain delves into all those things, into what the purpose of Stonehenge is and the pyramids of Giza and the Kukulkan pyramid. It sort of ties everything up into one thing that evolves around.
I don't want Steve Alton to give away the whole story of the series, but what is the meaning of Stonehenge?
Well, it serves a purpose, but it's a red herring, and I don't want to tell you exactly what it is, but it was created by the same group of, you know, basically an advanced race of humans who visited our planet and stuck around and helped seed the Homo sapien race, and in essence, they were part of our evolution. There's actually an amazing passage in the Bible that deals with this, and that passage is Genesis 6, and it deals with Nephilim, that there were sons of gods who came to man and impregnated our women, and it's the most mysterious passage in the Bible, and all of this deals with me as an author is that, you know, for a reader, the lines of fact and fiction are so blurred that you're just not sure what's real and what's not real in
that. Well, that brings you, you mentioned Mega earlier. That was a sequel. You have a sequel to that book, too, right?
Meg series is made up of Meg, The Trench, and Meg, Primal Waters. There'll be a fourth Meg book, which I'll talk
about. Now, what is the difference between that series and this series?
That's totally two different stories. Meg is about the 70-foot prehistoric great white shark called Megalodon that has been inhabiting the deep water trenches of the world, and Domain is about really the Mayan prophecy, the end of the world, and what happens next.
So basically, Meg is similar to Jaws, but different.
To a Megalodon shark, Jaws was just a snack. You're talking 70-foot version of a great white. The biggest great white ever hooked on a line was about 26 feet. So, of course, Jaws exaggerated it a bit, but megalodons were legitimately 70 feet long. We've got their teeth, which some of them are over 7 inches in length. I mean, this was just the most monstrous predator ever to inhabit.
Now, you live in Florida. Do you live near the beach?
About 20 minutes away, but... I mean, megalodon is...
You're not afraid to go in the water?
I'm wary of the water. I'm not worried about a megalodon, per se. They're too big to come near shore, but we get bull sharks, and they're pretty nasty.
You've been pretty fortunate, I think, with the critics. Not that you don't deserve the good reviews, but you basically get pretty good reviews, don't you?
They get better with each book, and I guess I've become a better author with each book. There's no experience like experience, and... my last book, which came out a couple summers ago, The Lock, is about the Loch Ness Monster, and that one got 5-star reviews, so, you know, I'm not satisfied, but I'm pleased.
As a kid, were you interested in terrible, horrible things like this?
Absolutely. yeah, I don't consider them terrible, horrible. I just think the forces of nature, I think, are amazing, and those tend to be... parts of the storylines in my book. You know, Resurrection deals with... Resurrection was actually written back in 2003. It came out in 2004. And a lot of the things in my books have a tendency to come true. For instance, there's a part of the storyline in there that deals... And Resurrection takes place in you know, 2012 and 2030. It actually splits up because it follows the lives of these two twin boys, which were the sons of the hero, and which fits into the Mayan creation story of the Mayan hero twins. And as we follow their lives, we also follow the goings on in the world. And one of the things that's going on is that global warming has created these super hurricanes that are in excess of 190 miles per hour, and you know, we're seeing those things even after the book was written. So, you know, if you do the research, a lot of times things have a tendency to...
So basically, that's what you attribute it to, is research and logic.
Yep.
More than psychic ability. And the ability to foretell the future.
I have no psychic ability, but I look at the current events and research things very well, and you know, it's just like the Shell game, which will come out in 2007. You know, it's oil is an energy source that is running out, and what's going to happen when it does run out? Well, we know it's running out, you know, and we are so addicted to it. And when I say addicted, you know, the people who make money are just making money off of it and refuse to let us get off that addiction. And that is, you know, the White House, the Senate, the Congress, you know, big business that supports elections and shake through that.
Right. All of that in itself is its own little horror story. But do you have something in the supernatural in this new book coming up?
Shell game, no.
Okay. It's just basically logic about the way things are working out. Politically and geologically.
And it's also, it deals with, has a through line that the neoconservative movement wants to take things, you know, into their own hands because it is a threat, and it will be a threat very soon, and that's a nuclear threat. And it's not that the real threat, which you don't read about too much, amazingly, I mean, it was just on the cover of Time magazine, but the real threat of Iran is not that they would have nuclear missiles, but that they would give them to terrorists. And so the real threat to America is that, you know, terrorists, Al-Qaeda and other organizations, can be armed with suitcase bombs, you know, a 10 or 20 kiloton suitcase bomb. Almost impossible to detect, almost impossible to stop. And if you had 10 of these things go off in our 10 largest cities, I mean, it would make 9/11 look like a firecracker. And it just, and so in order to sort of stop this, the neocons are going to engage in another 9/11 event. And that's really what the shell game is about. It's scary stuff. It's actually scarier than sharks and doomsday problems.
Right, right. And in my, you know, in my own personal belief, I think you're fairly close to the truth.
Oh, I know I am. That's what's really scary. I mean, I've got people working. I've got, one of the things that I do is I stay in touch with my fan base. I put my personal email in all of my books. I answer my own email every day for several hours. And so I meet people. And when you have the ability to meet people in certain organizations, they'll tell you certain things, you know. And
what are they telling you? That that just basically what you're laying out could be the truth.
Yeah, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And you know,
you think any is there any hope? That
yeah, there is hope, but you know, the first hope is that we need to put in elected officials who will address the fossil fuel industry and put it in its place and move toward alternative energy sources, because that's something that we have to do. I mean, you know, one of the problems, first of all, if we're really going to fight the war on terrorism, we have to get off the fossil fuel needle. We have to, because we just allow too many things to happen because of our need for oil. For instance, in the paper today, there was one of the oil-producing countries in Africa is, you know, we embraced their leader yesterday. Condoleezza Rice embraced their leader, and you know, we call them allies. But the truth of the matter is they're not a democracy. They're a dictatorship, and they're abusing the rights of their own citizens. But we allow it to happen because we need their oil. And we're competing for China, you know, with China and Indonesia and other places for oil right now. And oil is running out. Oil peaked. World oil peaked back in 2003, and what that basically means is that we're sliding down the other side of the slope. It's we're using more oil every day in the world than we're pumping out of the ground. So it's just a matter of time until it runs out. And some say it'll happen in a decade, and some say it'll happen in two decades. Maybe it'll happen sooner. But when it does happen, you know, we're in a pretty bad situation, because what does oil really do for us? Well, the major thing that we have yet to replace oil with is a means to run our cars, our transportation, and that affects the food industry. You know, there's less than 2% of the country are farmers, and they provide food for the entire country. And the reason that we're able to do that is because we have machines that run on oil and gasoline. We have trucks that bring food to market, so we can go down to our local grocery store and buy food. Well, you stop gasoline, and all of a sudden, you stop food production. So what are you, where are you going to get your food from? Are you going to grow it in your backyard? Are you a farmer? Because I'm not a farmer. You know, I'm not prepared to feed my family with food that I grow in my backyard, and that leads to anarchy, and that leads to other things. It leads, you know, in the cold winters, you know, we're not going to be affected as much here in Florida as you would up north. But you know, what if you don't have fuel to heat your home? And in the summers, you don't have air conditioners. So you know, this is the cliff that we're heading for, and yet the powers that be, our elected officials, are, because they, you know, are almost subservient to the oil industry, are allowing these things to go on and on and on. And you know, titled the book The Shell Game, because it is a shell game. And if you're familiar with the shell game, it's you know, three shells and a little ball, and
yeah,
it's a gambling game. But it's a setup. You're set up to lose. You can't beat the shell game, because it's a setup.
Yeah, you know, we'll get off of the neoconservative movement here in a minute on the discussion, but you mentioned the suitcase bombs, And all the time, every time I hear this, I keep thinking about, well, now, in the 80s, we were talking about the Soviet Union collapsing and all these suitcase bombs running around. Well, I haven't seen any yet. I wonder if they really exist.
Well, why?
If there are really terrorists that are that good, then why haven't they done something?
Well, it's not the suitcase bomb. It's the plutonium or the enriched uranium, which is what the whole discussion with Iran is right now, that they're going to start enriching uranium, and that's used in bombs. You know, the amount of uranium or plutonium that you need to create a suitcase bomb is about the size of a grapefruit or a softball. With that much uranium, enriched uranium or plutonium, you could basically create a bomb that would equal the atomic weapon.
I understand what you're saying, but let's say the neoconservatives are right, which I don't think they are. But let's say they are right, and they bomb Iran to oblivion. Well, there's enough plutonium laying around, used to yellow cake or whatever, that if they're real terrorists, they could pick it up and build something.
Well, go back a step. We're not going to bomb Iran unless something happens, and that's the...
I'm not so sure.
Well,
I hope you're right.
I mean, there's a lot of ramifications. If the invasion of Iraq hadn't have happened, then it shouldn't have happened. But if it hadn't have happened, then maybe we would have been bolder to go after Iran. But Iran's a bigger country. It has a bigger army. It's a more dangerous country than Iraq was. And, you know, it opens up Pandora's box. If you're going to go into Iran and you're going to make it a parking lot, you know, by dropping nukes on it or biological weapons, more likely, if you drop a biological weapon, then you wipe out its population and you still have the oil. That's what they want. So,
you think they're capable of doing that?
Oh, we're capable of doing it, but you have to have it.
Well, I'm thinking more of a moral fiber, but you may be right there too.
Well, unfortunately, all of it's immoral. But I mean, on both sides of the equation, and, you know, I don't want to get too much into the storyline of the shell.
Yeah, I understand.
The book won't even be on the shelf.
Right. You know, there's another thing I want to get back to your present book. You mentioned the twins.
Zero twins.
Yeah. There's somebody else in that book that was born too, right? Same day or something?
There's all books need a villain, and this particular woman is...
I mean, it sounds like it's almost a takeoff of the Antichrist.
Similar, uh-huh. And this particular woman is born with the same powers as the hero twins have, and essentially her DNA comes from a future species of human being, and so she has these powers, but she's a little psychotic because of some things that have happened in her childhood. It wasn't her fault. But, you know, she's been, you know, we are products of our environment and how we were raised, and she was raised in some pretty nasty ways. And so she's convinced that she is the succubus Lilith. And the succubus Lilith is actually, you know, we've all heard of Adam and Eve. Well, believe it or not, if you really look at the Bible, that Eve is Adam's second wife. He had a first wife, and that was Lilith, who was the succubus, and he tried to take advantage of her, and she didn't want to have anything to do with him, so she sort of floated off into the wind, and Eve came along sometime later, but the succubus sort of comes to men in the middle of the night and can control them through...
How do fundamentalist Christians react to your books?
I don't get a whole lot of email from fundamentalist Christians. I do occasionally, but you know, my books are fiction, and it, you know, if that's what you want to read, then I mean, my job is to entertain.
Yeah, I'm just curious.
Something in my stories that, you know, are not grounded in either mythology or reality or science. So I mean, I didn't make this stuff up. I'm just using it as part of the elements of the story.
When you write these things.
Not to interrupt you, Jerry, but if you go to the internet and you type in Lilith or the succubus, you'll get everything that I just said. I mean, it's not something that I created, but it makes for a great element in a story. So would a fundamentalist Christian object to me using that in a story? I don't think so. I had Resurrection is a racy story because Lilith, who's a major character in the story, when she grew up, her step-grandfather, when it happens, what we read about it is that, you know, the church, the Catholic Church was sued, and they came out with a couple $1 million to keep everything quiet, or this and that happens, or sometimes somebody's arrested. But you never get into how it affects the child and what kind of psychological problems it causes for the child. Well, resurrection does get into it. And I've had a couple people, women, who have emailed me and said, you know, I loved all your books, but resurrection I didn't like because, you know, you got into a subject matter. And I said, well, I always email people back. If they email me good, better, and different, they always get an email back. So I said, well, I'm sorry you feel that way, but, you know, the whole story, you'll see that she does a complete cycle, and she comes out in the end in a different person. But and it turned out that this particular woman has been raped, so it hit some nerves, and, you know, she apologized later.
Yeah, I understand. It's... We get all kinds of emails, and the unintended consequences are not only political, they're emotional things when you deal with emotion.
Sure.
And people, at least in my experience, come up with reactions that I never thought would occur. And then you talk to them by email or whatever, by mail or phone call, and you find out they have reasons for that.
Yeah, it hit a little bit too close to home.
Uh-huh.
That happens.
And that's a fine art. I think that as a fiction writer, a successful one as you are, you probably think about that, the fact that you got to do these things to trick the emotions or tweak the emotions would be a better term for it, I guess. But each time you get into emotional things like that, there are consequences.
Yeah, and with my books also, not as much with Resurrection, but with my other six books, and my books are being used in high schools right now as part of a program that I founded 8 years ago called the Adopt an Author Program. And Adopt an Author is a free program. It's a nonprofit organization that I set up. And the reason it came about is because I became inundated from email from teenagers who had hated to read until they read Meg, and then they read my other books, and all of a sudden, teenagers who hated to read were reading. And now, what was the secret of that? Because the books were fun. You know, it's a lot more fun to read a book about a 70-foot prehistoric great white shark than it is about, you know, Wuthering Heights or The Scarlet Letter or whatever it might be, the books that they've been using in high school curriculums since I was a high school student. But and nothing wrong with the classics, but let's face it, if you want to get kids to read who hate to read, give them something that's fun. And then teachers started emailing me and telling me, hey, we're using your book in your class. It's a great success. Just wanted to let you know. And so my background's actually in education. I have a bachelor's, master's, and doctorate degree in education. So I realized something good was happening on its own that I needed to become involved in. So I created the program, and essentially we offer free curriculum material, study guides, tests, quizzes, projects, everything a teacher could possibly use. And when the teachers are using the books in class, the students email me, I email them back, they get free newsletters every month, and then at the end of the unit, we'll do an in-class conference call over a speakerphone, or if the school is closed, I might visit it personally. And you know,
now do you have a place where they can get the information on this?
Yeah, any teachers out there who are interested in the program, and we're basically looking at middle and high school teachers. It's a secondary school program for English teachers and science teachers, language arts, reading, or special ed, and librarians. You can go to www.adoptanauthor.com. That's all one word, adopt an author. And you can register. It's free, and we'll send you posters, and we'll send you curriculum materials and everything you need to get started.
There is some redeeming social value to your tales of mystery and intrigue and science and myth.
Absolutely.
In fact, basically, and I'm sure you'll agree with me, you're probably more well-founded, in fact, with these fictional stories than most people are. Because you have to do your research to spin these tales.
Yeah, and what's...
And they lead, I imagine the facts lead to other ideas.
They do, and what's ironic is that I wasn't necessarily a good student in school. And now every book is an education because, you know, if I'm researching...
Yeah, we're about out of time, but I have to ask you, what do you make of the Mayan calendar and the 2012 thing? Do you have a personal opinion about it?
I think that something definitely could happen. And hopefully it'll be something positive. positive instead of negative, but you just don't know.
With that, we're going to close. Steve Alton, it's been fun.
For me too, Jerry.
Okay, thank you.